Senator Dill, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Senate File 98 is nearly identical to a bill or an amendment that I had last year that went into the tax bill and made it into conference committee but didn't get past the conference committee, and it deals with bonding authority for the city of Winsted to allow them to bond and do some construction projects that are very important to the economic well-being and future of the city. And I've got the mayor of Winsted with me, Steve Stotko, who would like to provide some testimony first, and then that'll be followed by Brent Merrick, city administrator.
Very good. Mr. Mayor, state your name for the record, please.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Steve Stotko, newly elected mayor of Winsted. Just to give you a little background about where Winsted's located, we're 45 miles directly west of Minneapolis, and we're in the northeast corner of McLeod County. We're probably about a mile from Wright County and a half a mile from Carver County. Our population, we're estimating, is about 2,400 right now. We've had significant industrial growth over the last couple of years. We've added 295,000 square feet of industry space and created 158 new jobs in the community. In the last four of the 5 years, we've been able to drop our tax rate. We're very proud of that. And the 2007 budget was also reduced by 1% over the 2006 budget. The city of Winsted has been renting space for our city hall, and we've been doing that for the nine and a half years. Over those 9.5 years, we paid $217,000 in rent, and we projected that if we stayed in the present building, we'll probably spend an additional $450,000 rent over the next 10 years. We've been working on this project, the city has, since 2003. We had 200 citizens involved in the Minnesota Design Team visit, which we called Spotlight on Winsted. The outcome of the design team were plans for leadership training, community parks, trails, plan use planning, and strengthening our relationships with our youth. The city has worked with the community to share our information on the project, and we used our local access channel, our website, and downtown informational kiosk, city newsletter. We've had open forums at a town hall meeting. We've had well over 200 people involved with this process. We're very proud with the outcome of the process. The project really becomes economically feasible when the city council began to pay off or transfer expanded bonds debt from the bond levy into capital facilities. So we're in pretty good shape. I walked into a very good situation, and I'd like to make sure that we continue on with the previous council's vision. Thank you.
Mr. Mayor, how big a community is Winsted?
It's about 2,400.
And you added how many jobs in the last recently?
We added 158.
Well, congratulations. That's a big deal for a rural town.
We're very proud of our growth. We're very lucky. People work pretty hard to get it to where it was. Previous councils, the city administrator, the whole community has been behind this.
Other testifiers?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Brent Merrick. I'm the city administrator, and if I'm able, I'd like to present just a brief history of what the community has done in the last 3 years to get to this point. So if I could all stand and give that presentation.
Had those 200 people come to a meeting, they said that this one should be city to deal with this area. They wanted to utilize this better as a community asset and resource. So the city council has already begun starting this project. A new public works building is being built in the city. And if we get approval from the state, we'd like to move forward and remove this building. And then the new city center would be in this area. And so the progression began with this. This was the first design team drawing that we had for the project in 2003. And you can see that it was basically an idea. And so we've spent the last 2 years, 2-3 years, getting people involved. And the city council set pretty specific designations for that. We had new members of the community on these boards, people that have been in Winston-Salem Heights, high school students, senior citizens, to all participate. And this was the first conceptual drawing that we had with the city center sitting here, and then a kind of revamped street and boulevard, and then there's a kind of a hillside in our lakeside park, and we build like little concrete benches in there for having our Queen's coronation and such. With that, we got to this final plan. So this would be our city center, a little plaza area, a one-way street for parking for these businesses. A lot of these businesses along this is First Street North in Winston have started to utilize the backsides of these buildings to put in new commercial spaces for themselves for increased rent. So this would be the rendering as proposed right now. This is our city center, which would include the community rooms, council chambers, police department, and administration offices, and then what we're calling the lakefront promenade to that city center. And then this is the front view of the city center on First Street North. And then this is the lakeside view. So your plaza area here, we have our Winstead Summer Festival here on the first weekend in August. And so you'd have some of our kids' games and hot dog stand and all those types of things in that area. Council chambers are community rooms, administration and police. And then this is the interior view. One of the biggest amenities the people, residents of Winstead said was our lake. And so working with our architects, as soon as you come into Winstead City Hall, you'd have a view of Winstead Lake. And our Lake Association has done a lot in the last 10 years to clean up Winstead Lake. Back in the 60s, the city was using that as a sewer dump. And over the last 10 to 15 years, there's really been a lot of work done through winter aeration and a really strong Lake Association to clean that up. And then just a final board on the area, the rooms, police department, administration, our community rooms are really lacking right now for a space for the Girl Scouts. Our senior dining would be in this area. Just community groups that are renting spaces from doctor's offices to meet. And we don't really have, as Mayor Stuckel said, a real sense of place. We've been renting for the last 9.5 years, and it's really been a fun process to be a part of this because we've been really transparent and wanting to get everybody involved because this is a big deal for a town the size of Winstead. So be happy to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Merrick, what kind of process did you go through with the citizens of the community to get them to buy in?
Mr. Chairman, we involved them completely and totally in the project. So once we had that design team visit, we put together these plans, and then we made presentations at the Chamber of Commerce. Mr. Mayor Stuckel, if you could pass me that brochure. We put out this guide and we mailed it to all the residents of Winstead. So it has all the plans, all the costs associated with the project, who was involved. And so then we also set up open forums, and we set them up at noon and at 6 p.m. on, I think, a half a dozen different days. So if people had specific questions about the program, they could come in. We also ran a longer version of that presentation 3 times a day on our local access channel, and it all culminated with a town hall meeting, which we had in September, and we asked the community to give the council a direction for where they wanted to go with this project. And so at that meeting, we gave the council a bunch of different options, and their The overwhelming opinion was for the city council to come to the state and ask for this special legislation that would give them the authority, because I believe that it's the net debt that is holding us back from being able to complete this project. So we've really had, on a project like this, usually have a real contingent of people that are against this project. And there's probably a handful, but I would say that the overwhelming majority of residents support this project and would like to see it happen.
So, Mr. Merrick, you don't think there's an issue with the language in here that says there's not a referendum of the people required? You don't think they're going to come march on the Capitol because the legislature did this without giving them an opportunity to vote on it?
Mr. Chairman, that was asked specifically at this town hall meeting. The mayor asked the community. They did essentially a straw vote and said how many people are in favor of the city council moving forward with this without, you know, a referendum. And I think the newspaper had it about 75 to 80% of the people had raised their hands. One of the issues that residents are struggling with not wanting to have a referendum is that if it went to referendum, the businesses would essentially be getting a tax cut because they would be a $150,000 business and a $150,000 home would be paying the same amount if it went to referendum. This is the way that our representative from Northland Securities explained it to us. And if it doesn't go to referendum, it's based on tax capacity value. And so the residents would prefer, I guess, or most residents would prefer it not to go to referendum. And Mayor Stucco could probably elaborate on that if he chooses.
Mr. Merrick is very creative and very helpful to the homeowner, I'm sure. And the revenue stream to pay off the bonds is just straight-up property taxes?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The city has been paying off bond debt, and instead of taking that off the tax rolls, we've been placing that in a capital facilities fund. And so this year, or actually for the past 3 years, we've been putting away $168,000, and we have another bond issue that's going to be $119,000 that's coming off the books next year. And so we'll relay that into the fund. And so for a $200,000 home, it'll be about $100 a year for them to complete this project.
Any other questions? Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Senator Bach's issue of the election, I assume you had an election this November. You have a new mayor. Was this a campaign issue in your local elections this year?
You're asking me this?
Yes.
No. It was not. We had a forum, a local forum, and at that forum, how they chose to do it was people would be there and they'd write questions down on the piece of cardboard or piece of paper and pass them over. It never was an issue. It came up. Everybody asked what the candidates' opinions were or positions were on it, and the council members running and myself were all for it. So they really didn't have a different vote or a different choice of candidates at that time. I think overwhelmingly the people are supporting of it. And I think just to add my two cents, I think what was really helpful was the way in which the council presented it to the public. I think that's what sold the whole program to the rest of the city. And I'm hoping to follow in that footsteps by involving the community.
Well, good luck, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you.
Senator Moore.
Well, Mr. Mayor, I would sell it to the members of the community, too, if I get that kind of real estate to go to work every day. It looks like it's going to be beautiful. Mr. Mayor, what is the population of Winsted again?
It's about 2,400.
2,400. And how many people came to your town hall meeting to sort of do the little straw poll for this
project?
There was
about 200.
100.
At the town hall meeting, 100. But there was 200 involved in the design team presentation.
Good. Mr. Chair, can council explain to me on the bill, line 114, letter the paragraph C? It's just for my own educational purpose. It says the bonds are not included in computing any debt limitations applicable to the city.
Right. Mr. Chair, Senator Moore, that is the gist of what they were talking about in terms of the purpose of the bill is twofold. One is to avoid the referendum issue, and then in paragraph C, the provision is that the bonds won't be included in the debt limit. And typically, there is a provision in the general law dealing with municipal debt that most, and there it's riddled with exceptions, but most city-issued debt would be subject to a limitation of 2% of the market value of the taxable property in the jurisdiction. So if the city has issued bonds that in the aggregate would reach that ceiling, they'd have to get an exception to this provision. And that's what this bill is doing for them.
So this gives them an exception. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Anything else from members of the committee? Anybody else in the audience want to testify? Mr. Mayor, Mr. Merrick, very nice presentation. Senator Dill, I'm not sure if this fits so much in the tax bill. It might fit in the public finance bill, but maybe both places. We'll make it fit someplace for you. So we're going to lay Senate File 98 over for possible inclusion in probably either the tax bill or the public finance bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. Just to remind the committee again, we did have this in the tax bill last year also, so thank you very much.
Yeah, we're aware of that.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senators.
Senator Scogin, welcome to the Tax Committee. Is this your first bill?
This is my first bill, so go easy on the rookie.
You're going to do just fine.
It's a simple one.
That's what they all say.
This is usually the committee where bills, simple bills, run into problems.
I wish you hadn't said that.
Senator Scogin, go ahead and proceed. Senate File 191.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. If you'll turn your attention to Senate File 191, it is a constituent bill that was brought to me by the town board in Scambler Township in Otter Tail County. It is regarding an aggregate tax. They have a large area in Scambler Township that produces gravel, and the chairman of their board is here today as well. As you can see, this is a tax that is available if the county elects not to collect it themselves. So we went to the work of contacting Otter Tail County commissioners in advance because we didn't want to put the state through the process if the county wasn't interested in supporting it. And I also have a resolution from the county commissioners on a 4-0 vote to support this bill as well. So if the state takes action, then the county is willing to support this action as well. With me today is Wayne Johnson. Wayne is the chair of Scambler Township in Otter Tail County. And he'll just give you a brief history on their gravel pit up there and what they hope to do with the tax money.
Hi, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for having me here today. A little background.
Mr. Johnson, your name for the record.
Oh, I'm sorry. My name is Wayne Johnson, and I am the chairman of Scambler Township. Just a little background. Scambler is located in the northwest corner of Otter Tail County, which for most of us means 40 miles southeast of Fargo, North Dakota. To my knowledge, there are currently 640 acres in our township that are either owned or leased by large gravel mining operations. On one of these sites, it's a 280-acre site. It is scheduled to be mined from 2007, which this summer it was began, until 2011. The mining company pulled 863,000 ton of processed material out of that particular mine. At that rate, just out of this one mine, there is estimated to be 3.7 million cubic yards of material taken out of our township and hauled through our township. The reason that we're here today actually is we went to Otter Tail County and asked them to enact this tax so that the township could share in and add to our road and bridge fund. The county declined, but they did, as Senator Scogin said, pass a resolution in favor that we be allowed to come and ask for special legislation. And so I guess the question comes to mind is that to me, when I think about taxes, because I'm not wild about most of them most of the time anyway, is this fair? Is it adding to consumer costs and those kinds of things. What I can tell you is I've talked to the plant manager or the operations manager from this particular mine, and what we were told was that since that they operate in many counties and actually a lot of what they do is in the state of North Dakota, they consider and figure in the gravel extraction tax or the aggregate extraction tax, excuse me, to the cost of their doing business. So if someone doesn't collect it, it basically just adds to their profit margin. What we plan to do with the money, I guess, is another good question that I asked myself, and I personally have three ideas. I would like to take, obviously, a percentage of it and add to our road and bridge fund to help assist in repairing and maintaining and upgrading of roads that are being used in our township by the gravel trucks and by everyone else in the township. One of the other things I would like to look at is reduction of property tax for our citizens. Because this would supplement our road and bridge fund, then obviously there's some money that we wouldn't have to include into the property tax. And the third thing that I personally would like to do is if any of you have seen some of these large mines at the point of reclamation or whatever, I'd like to put 25% of what we receive into a reserve fund. And take that reserve fund after the mines are closed and do a number of things with them. My personal purview of that would be to either assist a wildlife organization such as Pheasants Forever or Ducks Unlimited to purchase or lease this land so that it could be turned into public use rather than simply being turned back into whatever the mining company decides to do with it at that point in time.
And, Mr. Johnson, who owns the land today?
There's two different ownerships, Mr. Chairman. One of them is Aggregate Industries out of, it's actually, I believe, a foreign company. The other one is 320 acres that is owned by an out-of-state, but for sure an out-of-township resident that leased their land for mining to another company called Glacier Industries. To the best of my knowledge, Glacier Industries is a company based in Grand Forks, North Dakota.
Mr. Chair?
Sir Alexis.
Mr. Chair, this aggregate tax goes back a long ways. I think my county, Clay County, was the first one that had it. And the situation there was that the gravel is in eastern Clay County or western Becker. The gravel companies were driving all the way across the Clay County roads and the township roads, and most of it was going into North Dakota. And so the idea behind it was to collect the tax, and then I think Clay County distributes it back to the townships based upon where it comes from, and the idea is to use it for roads that are depleted because of the hauling of the gravel. So this goes back a long ways, but apparently Otter Tail County doesn't do it, and they just want the ability to do it. So they basically will be doing just what Clay County is doing. And I think there's some other counties in the state that do it as well. I should ask you, does quite a bit of this end up in North Dakota at Fargo?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Langseth, to my knowledge, yes. What's being currently processed, the tonnage I gave you is actually processed material. Because the volumes do not have to be figured as long as it doesn't leave our township, but the conditional use permit that we have with them says they have to tell us all of the volumes. To my knowledge, all of that processed material either goes to their operations in Fargo-Moorhead, which I believe is mostly Fargo as far as concrete mixing and that kind of thing. Some of it does go other directions, but I believe the majority of it goes out to North Dakota.
Senator Moore.
Mr. Johnson, when you said that you personally think, you know, in terms of what you are going to do with the revenue once it's collected, is that you communicating that to us, or is that a formal position of the board that governs the township?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that's my position, and as you know, there's three votes on the board, and so I can't speak for them. We have discussed this, but obviously we haven't taken any official vote. And I don't see any conflict on our board with that, but I don't want to speak for other members of the board. I'm speaking from my own personal view.
And Mr. Chair, just a follow up. So, Mr. Johnson, this piece of legislation, did it come forward on a formal resolution by the board to ask for this legislation, or was this something that you brought forth on your own? And hopefully, you know, this is something you can just take back home.
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, the Scambler Town Board unanimously passed a resolution also that said that we would attempt to enact this legislation.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair.
And Mr. Chairman, last year Sylvan Township was in the Senate tax bill as imposing a township gravel tax, and that wasn't acted in the law, so we do have a recent precedent of a favorable decision on this.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. To your question, are the owners of this land aware or in favor of what you plan to do with the usage?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm not quite sure on the owners of the land that's being currently mined, you mean, ma'am?
No, you talked about usage for Ducks Unlimited and Pheasants Forever. The owners that you indicated to the chairman, are they aware that you're going to use the land in a different way?
It's my intent, once it's done mining and the reclamation process, my intent would be to go to those owners and discuss that with them and see if they'd be willing to sell it for that use and use some of this money that we have collected for helping either one of those agencies purchase it, rather than because one of the primary owners is a large corporation that once it's mined out, they have no, in my view, they have no further use for it. Obviously, the people who own the land that have leased it, it's their decision, but I would just like to have it as an available opportunity for us.
Mr. Chairman, is there language in the bill like that? Or is that just, is this all just speculation?
Senator Johnson, I was going to mention to Senator Scogin before we lay this over that on line 1.15, where we talk about using the proceeds, I think we're going to want to spend some time probably giving the town some direction on what we think the proceeds should be used for, things like reclamation, things like road and bridge, to get kind of more in line with what legislative intent has been with taxes like this. So, Senator Scogin, when we lay this over, we're going to have council do a little work on that to kind of narrow up the uses of the aggregate tax. I don't think this committee is going to be willing to use it on to hold down property taxes, but if there are other infrastructure needs that are directly related to the aggregate extraction or mineland reclamation, I think that's kind of been this committee's intent. So
appreciate that,
just
Mr.
want you
Chair,
to be aware of that.
Look forward to your recommendations.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scogin, there are a couple of the things that I'd be looking for, and I'd like to see how much in revenues you expect to recover or claim out of this, whether the township is prepared to manage the collection of the revenues, because they don't usually collect revenues. So some kind of administrative mechanism for it. And then I'd like to see, if you could, what the impact on the roads are with this, the aggregate and the mining in townships neighboring yours. Is it just your township that's affected by this, or are there others that are affected by this? And should we be looking at maybe road and bridge funds in their townships as well?
Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, I believe Mr. Johnson informed me that they expect at the current rate to collect about $60,000 a year. They are in the northwest corner of Otter Tail County, so when they leave Scambler Township, they are in somebody else's county. So they don't come across any of the rest of my district when they leave the pit.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I wasn't there for eighth grade geography. I don't think I moved to Minnesota in seventh grade. And I'm wondering, Otter Tail County, does that border North Dakota? So they're actually, or is there another county that's affected?
No, we go into good Senator Langseth's district at that point.
Mr. Chair, they would either be going through Clay County or possibly Wilkin, but most likely Clay.
I believe Clay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up, these aggregate taxes, the reason why we have done them on a countywide basis is because so many are affected by the activities. And so I'm wondering if there are others that maybe should benefit from some of these tax dollars. I don't have the answer to that, but I hope that maybe you would inform me and the committee about that, whether there are others that maybe are feeling the burden from these activities as well.
Well, Senator Ortman, the county does have authority in law to impose the aggregate tax and have chose not to. So this isn't an unusual request. I think Senator Scoia was right. We did this for a township last year. I think, was it Senator Roots?
Silva. Mr. Chair and Senator Ortman, also, if the county changes its mind after 2 or 3 years of watching Scambler work with the aggregate company, if they change their mind, Scambler has to relinquish authority to collect that tax and turn it back to the county.
Senator Sundrum.
Mr. Chair and Senator Scogan, or your witness, I don't see in the bill any rate or for that matter any ceiling in terms of, and you did mention $60,000 a year, but would you tax on the basis of cubic yards or something like that?
Senator Sundrum, I think council can help. I think we have a number in law.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Sundrum, the tax rate would be that is in the general currently county tax, which is up to 10 cents per cubic yard or up to 7 cents per ton.
Okay. Thank you.
Is that adequate, Senator Sundrum?
Yeah.
Any other questions from members of the committee? Does anybody in the audience want to testify on Senate File 191? Not Senator Sogan. We'll lay Senate File 191 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill with the understanding that we're going to do a little work on line 1.15 and kind of define some uses for the town to use the money.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Senator Olson, welcome to the Tax Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Through the little community of Emily on, what's the highway that goes through? Is it 6?
It's a beautiful area, Mr.
Yes.
Chair.
Senator Olson, Senate File 315.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. This is also my first bill, and I feel very pleased and privileged to be here with Mr. Keith Reeves, a city council member from the city of Emily, and I would ask you to turn your attention to Senate File 315. This is a bill to approve a half-cent sales and use tax, which was approved by the voters by referendum last November. The purpose is to apply the funds toward a wastewater treatment plant. The beautiful city of Emily, which is located just north and east of Brainerd, is a small community of less than 1,000 people with a number of lakes and forests that they've been proactive enough to decide to use a wastewater treatment facility to protect the water in that area. And I would submit save us some money in the long term in terms of taking care of their natural resources in that area. So with that, I would like to introduce to you Mr. Reese, who will be providing you with the details of this request. Thank you.
Mr. Reese, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, Senators. As I said, my name is Kent Reese, and it's R-E-E-S in the spelling, which is usually different than other traditional spellings. And I'm a council member with the city of Emily. Over 7 years ago, the city of Emily made the decision to install a municipal wastewater system. The original cost was $3.2 million. A grant of $2.4 million was obtained for partial payment. With a project that was started over 7 years ago, there were some inflationary increases. The Crow Wing County required some road upgrades in the project area. Then there was also a few project changes, and it ended up there was a loan of $1,637,000, which was obtained from the USDA Rural Development. Emily is, I think, is unique in the fact that it encompasses 36 square miles, which is a traditional township size. And as I said, Emily is in the northeast corner of Crow Wing County and is approximately 35 miles northeast of the Brainerd-Baxter area, which is the center of commerce, really, for the county. All the residential and commercial properties waste in Emily are managed by individual sewage treatment systems. The new municipal wastewater system, which was installed in the core area of Emily, will serve the majority of the commercial properties and many of the residential properties also. The citizens believe that the infrastructure improvements is just one step in protecting the lakes, the rivers, and the groundwater of the community. The natural resources of this area is one of the principal reasons that many of the families elect to reside and live in this area, and it is also tourism is also a very important part of the economy of the area. With the projected population growth for Minnesota, and particularly for Crow Wing County, they were projecting 50,000 population growth by 2030, which is only 23 years from now. The pressures upon the environment, of course, are going to increase rather significantly. We have obtained some information from the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and if there is legislative approval for the local sales and use tax, it will still be necessary for Emily to budget a property tax levy. The local sales and use tax will help in controlling the property tax increases that will be necessary. It was in 2006, actually it was in March of 2006, the Emily City Council did pass a resolution indicating interest in the sales and use tax. And it said the voter referendum was obtained last fall's general election on November 7th. The new city council, which became seated in January, has drafted a new, more detailed resolution reaffirming their position on the sales and use tax. And that resolution will be presented and voted upon and approved next Tuesday, the 13th, at the next city council meeting. From the city, we thank you for this opportunity to present this brief amount of information on our infrastructure improvements. We trust that you really see the need for the protecting the environment and the financial support to the citizens of Emily. If there are any questions, I'll answer them to the best of my ability. Thank you.
Mr. Reese, what's the timetable of the construction project?
The project has been completed. The construction was done last summer. It became operational in September of last year. There is some residents and commercial properties have connected last fall before freeze-up, and it is written into the city ordinance that all remaining properties must connect to the new municipal wastewater system by September of this year.
And when that happens, what percentage of the systems in the county will be actually run through the, will be taken off the on-site sewers and actually put into a community sewer? What percentage will still be unsewered?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I don't know if I have a percentage. The initial project covered 137 parcels of property, which would be through the center part, of which there are currently 110 dwellings or buildings which will be connected. The engineers tell me that the system was designed for, if I remember correctly, 250. But I have to remember, but since Emily is 36 square miles, many of the rest of the residents are beyond the core area of the city. As a matter of fact, that last year there was four or five requests from different segments just adjacent to the project that asked if it could be extended to their properties, but it was not financially feasible to do.
Mr. Reese, it will take 40 years. What's the term of the federal loan?
It is 40 years at 4.37% interest, and I think the annual payment is around $88,000 approximately.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What is the population of Emily?
Mr. Chair, Senator, the population of Emily, the last number I heard was 867.
Is, Mr. Chair, is that the reason it's going to take 40 years to pay it off?
Pardon?
That seems like an awful small tax capacity to be paying for this project.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Oh, Senator Olson.
Sorry. I think that's the reason why the city of Emily is hoping to have the your support for the additional, for the sales taxes, because they do have such a small population, but it's a very large tourist community, and they are all putting pressure on these resources and taking advantage of the beautiful lakes in this area. So that's the reason, because it does have affect more than just the local residents. And
Senator Orman. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Councilman Reese. Traditionally, I don't think the legislature has done local option sales for wastewater infrastructure. I don't know that it's ever done. Maybe Council could help me with that. But you did mention the property tax that you are going to be imposing, even if this does come through. Is that special assessment, or is that a general property tax, or what is the nature of the property taxes?
It would be a general property tax.
General property tax.
Sorry.
And what do you know, Mr. Councilman, kind of tax capacity is in the city of Emily, the 36 square miles?
Mr. Chair, sir, as a new council member, I don't know all those numbers yet.
I'll work with Senator Olson, and we'll see what we can find out there.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Councilmember Reese, can you tell me how many entities or businesses will collect the tax within the city? How many businesses will be collecting the tax?
Mr. Chair and Senator, how many businesses will be collecting? I think I have that number in my notes from the Department of Revenue, but I just don't recall it. The number that I do remember from the Department of Revenue was they projected, based upon a 2004 sales receipts from Emily, from the zip code, was 34,000, which is about half, a little less than half of what the annual loan payment would be.
Thank you.
Mr. Reese, those 100-plus parcels that are hooking up to the system, what are they paying for a monthly charge?
It is in the ordinance that residential properties have a $30 monthly charge, and then based upon water usage, it may increase. Commercial properties, it was $35 per commercial, and then based upon water usage, there would be an increase. The city of Emily, since everybody is on individual wells, the city of Emily did provide water meters to each property as they take out a permit, which needs to be installed, and then they will be outside remote read water meters so that their well will actually be monitored for water usage.
Private well?
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chairman and Mr. Reese, their private well will be monitored for usage?
Chair, I'm sorry. My hearing aids just don't pick up all
everything. Senator Johnson, I think that's true, and the point is if the water's running into the house, it's going out of the house. So the intent is to try to determine how much water is actually being discharged to the city's sewer system. I hadn't heard of that, but I think that seems like a reasonable thing.
Senator Mr. Johnson. Chairman, is there any intention of charging the homeowner for their usage of the septic in the future?
Can you repeat that?
She's asking if there's an intent to charge for the use of the septic.
Yeah, the runoff.
Any properties that are connected, which are currently on ISTS systems, those systems are abandoned. And there is the protocol for abandonment is in the MPCA Rule 70, I believe, so that they will be, all the properties will be 100% their waste, liquid sewage waste, will be go through the municipal wastewater system.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you, Senator Olson. We'll lay Senate File 315 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Senator Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I have a process question, only because for the last 6 years I sat under Chair Pogemiller, and when we were constructing our bill, we kind of rated each individual thing that came forward, and we just passed three bills on for inclusion, and none of us were asked to vote or give our.
Senator Johnson, I didn't say inclusion; I said possible inclusion.
Oh, Ms.
And on one of them, we indicated there definitely need to be some work done before it would be done.
Excuse me again, Mr. Chairman. Are we going to go back and readdress these bills and vote on them?
At some point in time, we're going to vote on all of them.
Okay, when they're all in a bill, and then we'll talk about the bill?
We'll be putting a bill together by article and going through article at a time.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I think that's pretty consistent the way the finance committees do.
And Mr. Chair, just because I'm so 6 years into doing it another way, I just have to get used to a different way.
Thank you. I will say Senator Pogemiller suggested not only to me but to the other budget chairs that they might want to consider his scoring method. And I guess I'm not familiar with it. I guess I don't know today if anybody has adopted it or not, but I believe it was actually a carryover from his days on the Education Committee that he carried to the Tax Committee.
Mr. Chairman, that shows how much influence I have. I don't think anybody's adopted it.
Senator Langseth?
Mr. Chair, one of the people who will testify isn't here yet, so we're wondering if you could go to the job zone overview and then hopefully get it before the end of session. They're coming from a long ways, so we want to get it done this meeting. But
I think we had a note that the department couldn't be here until 10 o'clock.
Oh.
Jobs these.
I think
it was
in an email. Well, we could Mayor, it looks like we've got a half an hour lag time here. Do you want to go forward? And okay.
Senator Langseth, I see Mr. Moe from Deed is here. It could be the department is ready. We might be able to buy you a little time. Members, I thought it might be helpful, considering that the governor has a Job Z proposal in his tax bill that he sent us, if we had a deed come in and do a little overview of what's been going on with the Job Z program here in the state, so that we can make a good decision on whether we want to continue it or maybe make some modifications to it in this year's bill. So I asked Mr. Moe to come and do that for us. I want to thank him for coming, especially I know we had thought you were going to be a little later, but the committee has been processing our work so quickly today. We're getting to you a little earlier than we anticipated. But
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you very much. Paul Moe, Deputy Commissioner, Department of Employment and Economic Development, and thank you for indulging my time as well. This is no problem to be here. Commissioner Ward Ines from Revenue was here, I think, a week ago or so, and highlighted an initiative that the governor is proposing to make a change or clarify some provisions of the Job Z, Job Opportunity Building Zones, as the program is called, Job Z for short, now in its fourth year of operations. And I believe all of you have a PowerPoint presentation. Hopefully you have those. I'd like to just walk through a little bit, if I could, a little bit of the background of Job Z, its history, and where we are today, and the reason for the request to change. On page two, the question is, why Job Z? Why was this program or initiative important? And it really addresses a couple of things about economic and community vitality, especially in rural Minnesota. Some of those areas that are under invested, if you will, compared to their counterparts in the metro area. So it was really created to address kind of an economic and private investment stimulation, if you will, job creation component, similar to many other economic development tools and programs. In addition to that, it was designed, or the impetus was, to address community vitality. And as you know, communities prosper to the extent that there's business, thriving businesses and employment and so forth. So to the extent that the schools and the local businesses and the local retailers and housing market and so forth kind of be more robust as a result of business activity, addresses the community vitality as well. On page three, again, part of the thought process behind the program is to address some of those challenges in greater Minnesota about the demographics, population trends being declining and so forth, and the economic base, to stabilize economic investment or economic base in rural Minnesota. On page four, it just talks about or demonstrates the population change by county across Minnesota. Interesting to note, between the years 2000 and the year 2005, 34 Minnesota counties lost population. On page five, when the program was established or created by legislation in 2003, it became effective in 2004. We spent the summer and fall of 2003 promoting and encouraging regional areas, if you will, to make application for zone designations. And at the end of that process, we awarded some 28,000 plus acres of Job Z eligible, if you will, Job Z designation. And you can see the acres by region in the state, and the number of communities that have the zone designation. We have 10 zones by region. We also have hundreds of subzones within collectively within these regions as well. On page six, this is some general characteristics of the program targeted to greater Minnesota. The law as it currently states the exemptions are available to the qualified business until December 31st, 2015. So the first year of operation, they really had 12 years of tax benefits, if you will. As time goes on, those benefits diminish. For new qualified business that sign up for the program, now 8 years left in the program. Again, I said before, 10 zones were approved. And it is a really additional kind of business economic development or community development tool that communities use as they promote themselves as a place to businesses and make investments. The goals of the program: provide tax exemptions to stimulate economic development, private investment, in rural areas and still be affordable to state and local governments. On slide number 8, this highlights the tax exemptions that are provided by the program: corporate franchise tax, income tax for operators or investors, sales tax on business purchases, capital gains tax, property tax, and employment tax credit for high-paying jobs, a threshold where there are some tax credits available for high-paying jobs. On page 9, talks a little bit about accountability, measuring results. Each one of the now almost 300 businesses that have signed up for the program enter into a business subsidy agreement, which identifies the number of jobs that they promise to create, wages that they expect to pay those employees, capital investment that they intend to invest in that community. Relocation agreements are those in which there are currently in Minnesota or in a particular community and expanding either in that community or elsewhere in Minnesota in a qualified zone, and the tax exemptions or tax benefits accrue only to that increment increase in investment, not taking existing businesses, not taking existing tax rolls off the tax rolls. Again, tax returns identify the amount of tax benefits, if you will, by business surveys. Each one of these businesses submit a survey with their application that talks about the jobs, private investment, reasons for making the decision, and so forth. In addition, we have surveys or input that we get from our zone administrators and sub-zone administrators as well. Another component of this program I want to highlight is really a local administered program. As I mentioned before, each business enters into a business subsidy agreement that is really an agreement or contract between the local business or local government and that business. And I talked about some of the provisions of those agreements, but those are locally administered programs. Obviously, it has to meet the eligibility requirements established in statute or some other local thresholds that they might establish as well. The program is used with other or promoted with other development tools that the community might have. Local units of government establish sometimes their own business subsidy criteria, and the local monitoring and reporting of goals. The local units of government or their staffs, I should say, do the monitoring of the projects. Look at slide 11. It's a map that shows where each of the projects are, and it shows by year, 2004 being the first year of eligibility, 2005 and 2006, the number of projects by year and their location. What's not shown in the map, but I'll highlight this, is to date there's almost 300 projects signed up, I think 286 through 2006. Roughly a third of those projects are in communities of populations under 2,500. The next third are in communities of populations between 2,500 and 10,000. And the last third of projects are done in communities of over 10,000. I should also point out on that slide on page 11, the decrease in projects by year, and one of the factors for that might be the fact that the benefits diminish as time goes on, thereby really diminishing the power, if you will, or the benefits of the program. Therefore, there may be some less participation. One of the reasons for the change, which I'll get to in a moment. Slide 12, business types. The majority of these businesses that have entered into the program are manufacturing or value-added, some construction-type businesses. And you can see the percentages by business types there. And I think this addressed what we'd hope to be would be those manufacturing value-added type projects. On slide 13, it talks a little bit about JobZ to date and its measures, results, if you will. Through December 31st, we have 286 business subsidy agreements signed. They have indicated a promise, if you will, to create 4,000 new jobs. I will say that for the projects that entered agreements in 2004 and 2005, the actual job creation for those projects was 3,673. And the average hourly wage of those 3,673 jobs is $14.99 an hour, which I think is significant wage considering the location of many of these projects. Capital investment of $400 million, again, identified in the business subsidy agreements or their surveys to say this is what the business plans to spend in capital improvements, capital investment in these communities. If we look at the total acres designated, some 28,000, more than 28,000 acres, about 2,500 of those acres have been put under a jobs agreement, if you will. Slide 14 talks about the cost-benefit analysis, if you will. The tax benefit, if you will, or the tax exemptions, including all the tax exemptions that I highlighted in an earlier slide, for 2004 projects was $6.4 million. In 2005, that was $12.1 million. And these are determined from the Department of Revenue's tax returns and information they receive from each of the businesses. There was no property tax allocation in 2004 because it's 2005 payable. So the first year property tax was impacted was 2005, and that was $1.1 million. And again, this is not a reduction in property tax. It's a shift, if you will, in property tax. The local units of government and taxing jurisdictions had to spread that over the remaining property taxpayers. Of the 4,000 jobs that are expected to be created, some of those already created, obviously, another spin-off jobs or indirect jobs, if you will, is a 6,000. And if we look at the jobs actual created plus the spin-off jobs, it's a conservative estimate of some $200 million payroll. We continue to work with Department of Revenue on 2006 tax returns and hope to have those results sometime late February, hopefully early March. The last slide, slide 15, really talks about the initiative or the proposal. As I mentioned earlier, the program expires December 31st, 2015. So any business gets the benefits of that program through 2015. Now it's 8 years left, next year 7 years left, and as time goes on, the period of benefits will diminish as the program expires. What the proposal provides is the program to sunset 2015, but that each business that signs up gets 10 years of benefits. So if a business signs up now, they get 10 years of benefits. If they sign up next year, they get 10 years of benefits. If they sign up December of 2015, they get 10 years of benefits, but no other business would qualify after December 31st, 2015. This would continue to have participation at maybe not as robust as 2004 year, which we had 130 projects, but we think maybe 50 to 60 projects per year with this provision, which is a significant contribution to the rural economy and meets the objectives of the program. I thank you for your time, and we'll stand for any questions.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Moe. If you go to back to page 14, I have a question about the if those are accumulative numbers or if they are the tax benefits for 2004 is $6.4 million. Then the 2005 tax benefits, does that include also the projects that were begun in 2004, or is that just the projects that were begun in 2005?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think that's cumulative effects, and we'll get clarification from revenue on that.
Thank you.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Moe. I was looking at the cost-benefit analysis, and you've got expected spin-off jobs and estimated payroll. I'm assuming those are estimated and expected off of the applications for the Job Z proposals. What happens when a Job Z applicant submits their proposal to create so many jobs, and they get their application and they build their facility, get their sales tax exemption on the materials or whatever all they're going to get, and they actually start up and create the jobs, but, you know, for some other reason, like they had too large of part of their business in one contract and they lose that contract, so they're no longer functioning as they had expected and promised. What happens then? Do they lose their sales tax exemption and, you know, they're not fulfilling their part of the deal? And how is that, how do you account for that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the business subsidy agreement provides for a period of time in which the business can create the jobs that they promised, and that's typically 2 years. 2 years maybe, and some change sometimes. At the end of that period, I think the first response from the business and the community and the state might be, can we provide an extension to give them more time? And the law provides for that. And we have provided that on some occasions where the business, for reasons sometimes outside of their control, says, I cannot meet the expectations that I thought I could 2 years previous. So we've extended those 1 year. Because the duration of the program now is into its fourth year, we've had some of those businesses that received the extension and now are coming into the scenario where they may not yet have received those expectations, if you will, and we have to sit down with the Department of Revenue on in some kind of a case-by-case basis and evaluate the facts about why they did not meet the objectives and then determine what kind of recourse we might have, including maybe paying back some of those benefits that they received, no future benefits and those types of things. So it's a situation that we're just coming onto now because of the duration of the program, and we will sit down with revenue and kind of work through those case by case, if you will. I can tell you that of the 280-some projects, less than 5% have really come up to this where they failed to meet the goals within the time period.
And, Mr. Chair, what would happen if one of the projects did meet their goals in the first year? You know, so they had the jobs, but then because their business suffered, they had to let some of those workers go, and what happens there?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that may be a case, and we'll have to evaluate the reasons or circumstances around that and determine what provisions the law provides for penalty, if you will, or recourse, and work through those.
And so, Mr. Chair, so you will be evaluating all of these business over the next 10, 15 years or whatever it is to ensure that they're meeting the job goals that they had committed to?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes. Each year we get a report from each of the businesses that identifies their goal and their actual compliance with those provisions.
And, Mr. Chair, is there any business, Mr. Moe, that you are – you said 5% of them that are struggling to meet the goals. Is there any business that you're looking at potentially having to pay back part of the?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, there probably will be a scenario like that. I'm hesitant to identify one right now because we have not yet determined the extent of those.
And then one final question, Mr. Chair. When I asked my question, I made the assumption that the expected spin-off jobs and estimated payroll generated, those were from the applications. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Senator, no. What the business subsidy agreement provides for is the actual business itself in terms of the job creation of goals. The 6,000 estimated spin-off jobs is really an economic model, if you will, to say if this type of economic activity occurs, then we can expect this additional type of job creation. Not under contract.
Oh, and Mr. Chair, so then the estimated payroll generated, is that from the job ZZOBs jobs or from the spinoff jobs?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, that would be both. Both the actual jobs and the expected spinoff jobs.
Wow. And Mr. Chair, Mr. Moe, at some point will we get actual, you know, results of what's being created?
Mr. Chair, Senator, we have today each one of these business subsidy agreements and the reporting is online on our website, so you can see each one of the agreements. And that, what I said earlier, the 2004 and 2005 business subsidy agreements have created actual jobs of 3,673, I believe is the number.
3,607?
And every year we will update that to say these were the expected jobs and these are the actual jobs.
Yeah. Thank you.
Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Deputy Commissioner Moe, could you talk about the impact on local school districts? I assume that school districts would be exempt from referendums or any bond levies that go out because businesses are exempt from property taxes, and what impact that's having on school districts?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I'm going to defer that to revenue in terms of how taxing jurisdictions play into that school district. If someone's from revenue here that wants to address that, that'd be great.
Senator Stephen. My name is Mark Peterson. I'm an attorney with the Department of Revenue. As to your question on the effect of this on the schools, under the job seize statute, the property tax exemption does not apply to school levies that were approved by voters before January 1 of 2004. But for the ones approved after that, they'd be exempt. As to the actual effect on the schools themselves, the commercial property ends up being subject to the statewide levy. So really, the local school districts end up essentially collecting taxes from businesses around the state. So they're not really at a loss there.
Senator Stephen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess this question is for Deputy Commissioner Moe. Again, I understand that hourly wage is about $15 an hour. Do you have any data on whether that includes benefits as well? Or what percent, you know, include benefits, health benefits?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the $14.99 is actual cash wage. Many of these jobs do have benefits, which is not included in that number. Mr. Chairman and Senator, I don't know the exact percentage of those jobs that do pay benefits, but we can find that out.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Lemire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple questions on Job Z. First, I wanted to bring your attention, I think, to Map 5. You describe approved Minnesota job zones by number of acres, and I find that rather an unusual definition. Why are you defining the number of acres? Why is that important to us?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, when the program was established, the provision really established that commissioner working with other agencies establish zones by acres, and communities applied to us to say these are the number of acres in our community that we would like to make eligible for Job Z activity, if you will. Some acres were denied, but by and large they were approved as the communities worked through their process with their regions to say by acres. And it was patterned after maybe a model that Pennsylvania used, which established zones.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. One of my concerns is that when we define by acres, you can only have so many people own a parcel of land. And it has nothing to do with the number of jobs you're going to provide or the economic vitality that you might bring to a community. But if you happen to be the one of the lucky few that own the parcel of land where that business or a renter that could rent that property, they become the winner. And the poor guy across the street that might be competing with you is not. And now we in the state of Minnesota has created a advantageous market position for the one person that's lucky enough to have the land to put the business on, the address, where the other guy across the street who may have been there for a while now no longer has that distinct advantage in the marketplace than what his competitor might be by being lucky enough to, however he got the designation to be officially accepted into the Job Z program. And I'm just wondering why we ever went down this path to define it by who owns the territory versus why don't we just qualify the program to provide X number of jobs to community at X number of dollars per hour or per salary? Could you explain why we got to that? Just because Pennsylvania does it, I don't know if that's necessarily a good enough explanation for me to accept.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, right. The acres was a device that we used to designate jobs eligible activity. I'm going to answer kind of in two ways. One is there is a provision in statutes that allows adjustment of acres. So communities can trade acres. A business will come and say, I would like to come to your community, but the plot that I want to invest on is not the one that is currently in jobs designation. So they made adjustments to trade acres within either the community or within the region to make that happen. Secondly, the business that is expanding gets the exemption for a relocating business, if you will, gets the benefits for only that increment increase in economic activity. So the competitor, if you will, using that example, would also be eligible to receive those same benefits provided they met the qualifications. And I guess if you want further discussion, I'll be happy to talk with you about that.
Mr. Chair, I certainly know how certain businesses with attorneys or lobbyists can affect the decisions in a city council. And I can understand how businesses may want to employ those individuals to suggest swapping land in an area. But there are other businesses that can't afford that, and they're just as viable as any other business. But moving on to another question, JobZ is set to expire in 2015, is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, correct,
2015. And do you have, in your operation, any anticipation of what effect that may have on those communities that rely on JobZ? Historically, when we've gotten into these kind of, for lack of another term, let's just use the word in the past, I consider them gimmick programs to spur on a little economic growth somewhere up north somewhere where they need economic diversity, where they need a vital, vibrant economy growing and creating jobs. But as soon as these incentives for corporations are done, the corporations pack up and leave. Can you give me any assurance that JobZ isn't going to have that same impact, and has your organization created any type of study on how to prevent that from happening when 2015 comes?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we have not done a study on that. We can certainly look into that question, and business decisions and investments and locations change over time. In 2015, the benefits expire, the program expires, but they will, assuming they sign up in the last month of the program, if you will, they still will have 10 years to maintain their business at a certain level to gather those benefits.
One last question. Is there any community impact that you've been able to measure with other businesses? Once a JobZ zone is established, they are getting new jobs, sometimes at a higher rate of pay. Do all the employees rush over to get the new jobs and leave the other business owner without anyone to work there anymore? What's happening out in little towns?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think that phenomena probably isn't unique to JobZ. It's unique to the marketplace, where a business is adding skill levels or adding productivity and is paying a higher wage, and labor will follow that. And that's something that probably occurs without JobZ to some extent.
Well, Mr. Chair, the only difference is you have basically a government subsidy program creating that very example. It's labor will follow where the money is, but usually you don't have government being the partner with that particular business subsidizing so that corporate interest can make a little bit more money and at the same time provide a better pay scale. But we kind of leave the other long-term corporate taxpayers out there trying to catch up, and they can't compete with a government subsidy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we, in addition to the JobZ program and other kind of business development programs, we have job training programs where we provide some dollars to NSCU system entities and businesses to provide productivity and adding value and skill levels to employees so they can be more competitive in the marketplace with wages.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Pogemiller, I've got a couple other people on the list, but the chair wants to get one question in, I think. First, Mr. Moll, I read with great interest probably about a year ago that Anderson Windows was going to be one of the recipients of JobZ. I think it was up in North Branch, or somewhere just north of here. And I was a little concerned about the fact, I mean, Anderson Windows is a fine company, but when I look at the designation of JobZ zones in 469.314, it says that in the designation of JobZ zones, the commissioner shall consider the need and likelihood of success, Anderson Windows is certainly going to be successful, to yield the most economic development and revitalization of economically distressed rural areas of the state. Economically distressed rural areas of the state. My concern, Mr. Moe, when I look at the map of where all the JobZ activity has happened, if our intent was to try stimulate economic development in economically distressed areas of the state, and that's what the statute says, I'm not sure we're getting that when I look at where all the little dots are. I mean, Senator Senjum is a good friend of mine, but there's a lot of dots around Olmsted County, and I got a pretty good hunch that Olmsted County doesn't meet anybody's definition of distressed at this table. So I want to spend some more time, and I'd like the department to think about that as we kind of move forward. If we're talking about an expansion of the program or continuing the benefits for a longer period of time, I think we have to get back to more what the intent was in those economically distressed areas. But back to Anderson Windows. I read recently, you know, they got an expansion, got JobZ, but I read recently that they're cutting, I thought the paper said about 400 jobs in Bayport. And I'm just kind of perplexed. You know, we get JobZ up at North Branch, and we add some jobs, and then we cut some jobs in Bayport. Does that put Anderson Windows in a provision of some position of clawback provisions at North Branch because they cut jobs somewhere else in the state? Or how has the department thought about how that might work?
Mr. Chairman, thank you for your comments. The Anderson project is actually a renewal by Anderson division, if you will, which is the plastic extrusion, which makes the replacement window market, which is obviously more robust than for them now than their traditional new construction component. The Anderson project in North Branch, we were in a highly competitive situation with Wisconsin, and without JobZ, I think Anderson would tell you would be in Wisconsin. In terms of the number of jobs in North Branch as it relates to that, I'd have to look at the relocation agreements and the agreements and see how that is specified in there. But remember, the Anderson project in North Branch is only getting the tax benefits, if you will, for the North Branch activity. It does not apply to any component of the Bayport facility at all. And again, we get reports from them annually to say, here's how many jobs are in North Branch. To my knowledge, none of those have been transferred from any other part of their business. But that is something we'll have to look and see what that language, how that is addressed in there.
But, Mr. Moy, I think Anderson Windows is a union company, so I'm kind of interested if the people working at Bayport might have some bumping rights against the people up at North Branch. And so are we not creating new jobs and really, in this situation, moving jobs from Bayport to North Branch? And I don't have a clue if there's some separate contracts that prohibit that or...
And, Mr. Chairman, I don't have that either. I can tell you only that kind of on the surface, I think the skill sets of those people in North Branch because of the plastic extrusion is different than those in Bayport. But we can find out exactly.
It would be helpful if you could get a little more information of how those two activities that are going on in those two towns, how Job Z might or might not be impacted. Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Director Moll. You said that we had created 3,700 new jobs, I think it is, and I'm looking at the tax benefits for 05, and you did state that the property tax was a shift. I think we could argue that all of the tax benefits are a shift. It's just, you know, that the property tax is shifting onto the local jurisdiction and the other tax benefits are shifting on the entire state. But there's $13.2 million in tax benefits for 05 and 3,700 jobs, so that's about $3,700 to $3,800 a job for that 1 year, and that goes on for another 10 or so years. So we're looking at, you know, am I doing this correct? Maybe $37,000 to $40,000 tax benefits for each job that was created?
Mr. Chairman, can't argue with your math on that. I would have to, you know, defer to some of our folks in the department analysis to see what other economic benefits we might attribute to these jobs in terms of spinoff and tax revenues and those types of things.
Mr. Chair and Director Moll, does that seem pretty efficient, or are there more economical ways to create jobs in Minnesota? Because they all, the jobs we create, will have the same comparable spinoffs.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, other programs I'm familiar with, some federal programs have 35,000 kind of investment per job as a threshold. Our Minnesota Investment Fund sometimes goes up to 15,000 per job, depending upon the nature of the project.
Thank you.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Moe, it's always interesting when looking at this because it's pretty impossible to challenge the numbers because the same way you come up with the numbers, it's largely relying on business to tell you what their mind is. If they've already made up their mind to locate in a certain position, create a certain number of jobs, they tell you, we're going to do this if you give us the Job Z designation. How do you read the minds of the owners? I mean, I remember a couple years ago we had previous commissioner coming in and telling us about the Job Z designation for a movie theater somewhere up north that created two jobs, and well, that was a mistake apparently. How do you read the minds to know whether they were going to do this anyway? Because the whole assumption that these jobs were created because of Job Z implies that they wouldn't have been created otherwise, and I can't picture there being any business without the creativity to find an accountant who can come in there and explain how they will create the jobs with this, and but for Job Z, they wouldn't.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, two kind of answers to that. One is we can relate kind of anecdotal stories of our discussions with businesses and where they might be if not for Job Z, and we can relate some of those to you. Secondly, each one of these projects goes through a public process of a business subsidy agreement, a public hearing that says, here's the business, here's what we expect to do in terms of job creation, investment, and so forth, and the local units of government hear those stories and decide this is an appropriate tool to use to make that investment happen in their community, which is similar to other development programs that go through public discussion about the investment, the factors that go into that, and then establishing some thresholds that the business will achieve.
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me the best high-paying jobs that this creates are the creative folks who can come in there and explain how they should get Job Z as opposed to somebody else. I guess if I was finding a competitor getting a tax break like this, I'd feel it was awfully unfair. And I guess I'm wondering, when you're talking about these economic development, these communities, I understand differences in border communities. The previous bill, I think there's a difference there. But what if you took some of this money and just built up the infrastructure in some of these communities, transportation or high-speed internet. That would not only help the new companies be able to locate there, but it would help the ones that already are there.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, and we've supported that activity as well. We have community support programs, other business development programs within the department that do exactly that. We support infrastructure development. Job training is another component that we have in our department. So it's a combination of community infrastructure, skill levels of employees and so forth, and additionally this program, which solidifies an investment decision to be made in a particular community for a desired result.
Just one more comment, Mr. Chair. I remember hearing from a local official who was metro area, it was not Job Z, it was tax increment financing, telling how he heard from one of the business folks that came in that in the city that they were planning, and they had made their decision to move there, and the city staff were coming into them and saying, you know, you're going to want to apply for TIF here. I mean, that's the trouble with this sort of thing. It's no business would be, well, you'd be foolish not to apply. You'd be foolish not to try and get this. And as Senator Scoyer, somebody mentioned, these are all tax shifts. If somebody isn't paying that tax, somebody else is. And again, if you could prove, which you can't do unless you can read the minds of the people there, what would happen but for the tax break? I guess I think that the problem is it happens too many times. A business makes its decision and then decides, hey, we'll hold you over a barrel. We won't do this unless we get this tax break, and you have no way of measuring that. It's just how effective they lobby you, effectively they lobby the local officials.
Senator Pogemiller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, I was under the impression the acting commissioner was going to be here today, but maybe I get to ask those questions when he comes for confirmation before this committee. Which I hope would
Senator
happen.
Senator Pogemiller, I did think that Commissioner McElroy was going to be here because I had a conversation with him on Monday. I was surprised he's not here, but I hadn't heard from Commissioner Innes that he was going to be here.
Well, I was talking about the Economic Development, Acting Commissioner McElroy, and I hope that your intention would be to have him come when I presume Tomasoni's committee would. I don't know who's going to do the confirmation, but I would hope it would come here because, frankly, most of the economic development activity around here comes through the tax committee. So I would hope I had the opportunity at some point to ask him a few questions about Job Z.
Senator Pogemiller, I believe Senator McElroy's confirmation has already been taken up in Senator Metzen's committee.
Oh. Would you be adverse to having it down here also, Mr. Chairman?
Senator Pogemiller, I'd be very pleased to have former Representative McElroy here. I kind of thought he was going to be here today, but at least I was led to believe that. But I guess,
Mr. Chairman, I think he'd be happy to come here and
if we could set up a time that he maybe can come down and talk about maybe why the new initiative in Job Z. Maybe he could come explain to us why we should consider the governor's proposal. And then I think committee members probably have some questions of him relative to the program also.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I did have a few questions for Mr. Moe. Why, you know, when you look at the map, in terms of accountability, there's 29,000 acres eligible for Job Z. It doesn't seem very targeted. It kind of seems like, I mean, why shouldn't that be viewed as basically, well, this is something so we can put up signs outside of every town in Minnesota to say we're a Job Z zone? Because it doesn't look very targeted. It looks like there's all these zones, subzones, and everybody can be one. And that just doesn't seem to be hard-nosed conservatism. That seems to me kind of like something liberals would do. Everybody gets to be one. And I'm genuinely asking. It's always mystified me as I drive into every town. I don't think I've been in a town in greater Minnesota that doesn't have one of those signs up recently. And how much do those signs cost? Anyway, that's a minor question, but just tell me a little bit about the targeting of all this.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the process established when the program was created had local units of government work with, amongst themselves and within their regions, if you will, to identify those areas in their communities that would benefit from this tool to attract private investment. And through the process, they had public hearings and public discussion about each one of these parcels and submitted them to us to say, these are the acres within our community or within our region that we think that would be attractive to private investment, that would create jobs, and so forth. So in terms of targeting, targeting in the community, yes, targeting the region perhaps, 28,000 acres seems to be a lot compared with
it does seem like a lot, 28,000 acres.
Compared to the 2,500 that we've actually put under contract, if you will, yes.
Then, well, Senator Pogamiller, I think, and I'm not sure you were here earlier when I expressed my concern about, I thought the legislative intent was that this was going to be used in economically disadvantaged counties, and I think that's, or areas, and I think that's what 469.314 says, and we go further to indicate a bunch of need indicators that should be considered when we designate a zone. So I do think we've run a little bit afoul of kind of what people expected of Job Z. It's happening in places, I think, that don't meet my definition of economically disadvantaged.
On the suburban, on the exurban ring, where development's going to take place
in. And in some
anyway.
Other counties, I think, where I think economic growth is already happening and probably don't need this tool, where there probably are some counties that, you know, even this tool probably is going to make economic development difficult.
And then if I could ask Mr. Moe, is it the department's position that who makes the decision on the designation, a local community or the department? Who's the decision maker? Who decides to give up these tax breaks?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, the local units of government, through the process I described earlier, applied for, if you will, designation. And our department, along with the Department of Revenue, made those designations.
Okay, so in your view, it is it's two state agencies that make the determination about either but for or who deserves these tax breaks.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, yes.
Okay.
After a discourse, if you okay. will, from the local level.
And then, Mr. Chairman, why do you think people working at state agencies have a better idea on this issue of but for than a mayor or a city council? Why is that? Because it just seems to me that you're more removed from the actual activity that's being talked about. And it just, I've always wondered why. And let me just put that in context, because here's a question I'm going to ask the commissioner designate or the acting commissioner when he comes. I served with him on committees for years where he was the vigilant protector on tax increment financing because of all these bad decisions local government officials are making. And I just have a hard time understanding how that same person could be supportive of Job Z at the state level. It just seems inconsistent to me, because that would mean that you would have to think a state agency can make a better decision than an elected official, a non-elected official in a state agency, can make a better decision than an elected mayor and a city council. And I just have a hard time with that. In terms of accountability, in terms of understanding the actual situation, in terms of cutting a deal.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'll answer the first part of that question about the process. And each one of these business subsidy agreements is heard at council and made a decision at the council level in a public hearing process about what the benefits will be and what the promises made from each of the businesses.
Yeah, local government officials are deciding to give up state revenue. Easy decision. What rational local government official,
Mr. Chairman,
wouldn't say we would like you to make a decision to give up state revenue?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, also local property tax as well.
But they don't need Job Z to do that. They can create a TIF district. I mean, they absolutely don't need the state for that.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, correct. They don't need the state for tax increment financing.
So their advice is to the state, we'd love to have this designation because we're not giving up anything. You're giving up state revenue. And then somebody, non-elected official in some state agency, is saying, yeah, let's give up state revenue. And I just have a hard time on that in terms of accountability. And this is no criticism of individual people making these decisions. It's just that they're frankly, we don't know who they are. I don't know who they are. At least I know who the mayor is. I know who the city council is.
Anything else,
Mr. Chair?
Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chair, I think Senator Marty alluded to the fact that it's probably a little bit different for Board of City, and that in the bill we're going to have today, I think you'll find out some of this. But I think probably Job Z is the most important along the border communities than any place else in the state. In the case of Moorhead, for example, they didn't even have implement dealers in Moorhead. Now they've got two very large implement dealers coming over, and they both came from Fargo. And the state of North Dakota, because they've been in sort of in decline on population and so on, has gone overboard in all kinds of different incentives. And in order to kind of match that up, we've done things through the Border Cities legislation, but also I think made use of the Job Z more than most other communities in the state would. And when it's the difference between a business locating in another state versus Minnesota, then we get the total benefit of that, not just the community itself, but the state as well. So I think there may be some questions about some of these things of whether a business would have located in a community or not. But I think in along the border, I think it's pretty obvious that they have been able to get some businesses in Minnesota that they wouldn't have otherwise.
But Mr. Chairman, if I could ask Senator Langseth. But if we don't get the corporate franchise tax or the income tax from the operators or the investors or the sales tax on the business purchases, what is the benefit to the state?
Well, I think the benefit of the state is that they got a business they wouldn't have had. And in the life of a person, 10 or 12 years is a long time. In the life of a state or a community, it's a very short time. So those businesses will be there. If somebody had said something about business moving out once the benefits are up, but boy, there's been some very expensive infrastructure put in there, and they're there to stay. So once these benefits are up, this 10 or 12 years, then it's a total benefit to the state and to the community.
Senator Ortman.
Well, Mr. Chair, I just want to alert the committee that Senator Pogemiller and I may actually have a similar point of view about Job Z. I've become a skeptic. And the reason I've become a skeptic is it does leapfrog communities, and it's arbitrary. In my community, Carver County, I think most people think that we have a very good, solid economy, but it's just not true. We have the community of Norwood Young America, which is suffering greatly from depression and lost hundreds of jobs since I've been here in the Senate, and struggling to vote for a referendum for schools that are much needed. And so they're struggling right along the border in Carver County, and we have this arbitrary program of Job Z that says that neighboring communities in Hutchinson and McLeod can put together these programs for Job Z, and we can't in Norwood Young America because we happen to be on the wrong side of the seven-county metro area. And so my frustration with Job Z is that we pick winners and losers, and we pick them arbitrarily. And I can see where it might be a good idea to create new jobs, but if in the border communities, as Senator Langseth is saying, those jobs may be going to people who drive in from out of state, we've got big empty shells of businesses that aren't generating revenues for the state of Minnesota, I wonder what the real advantage is. And I'm not sure that I've seen the rationale for why we do what we do and where we do it. And I think that if it's going to be renewed, should really be revisited.
Senator, thank you.
Mr. Moe, I think you would be wise to express to the acting commissioner that there is bipartisan concern about the application of Job Z. And at some point, we'd like to ask him to come in and have some additional discussion with the committee. But before we dismiss you. I have a Senator Metzen had an overview. The legislative auditor did a report on prevailing wages, state Davis-Bacon law, and there were a lot of concerns raised by the legislative auditor about the lack of enforcement of prevailing wage on projects where it was applicable. And I understand it does apply to Job Z projects. I'm just wondering who, on Job Z project, who is the enforcement authority, and do we collect any payroll data if somebody wants to monitor it? I mean, how does that work? Because I've heard from a lot of people that nobody knows who's even responsible to collect any payroll data. So can you help me with, maybe that's one of the areas we should kind of clarify if we're going to make some modifications to Job Z, but who is responsible to collect or monitor the data?
Mr. Chairman, local units of government, or their staff, I should say, really are monitoring the Job Z projects, including all those components, prevailing wage and so forth, and they work with the Department of Labor and Industry on help on that. It was a issue raised in that report, and I think it's something that we need to think about, clarifying, where the help should come from, and resources that can be deployed in that effort. But to answer the question, it's really the locals that have been doing the monitoring and the compliance issues.
Well, and I think what the legislative auditor found is even where state agencies, and I think they cited the Minnesota Zoo, for example, that there was a lack of understanding even on the part of state agencies and MNSCU about their responsibility to try and enforce the law. So if the department could think about, I think, where we could clarify a little bit whose responsibility it would be to collect data and monitor the law's application. So I think we could clarify it in law. I think that would be helpful. So if you have some suggestions, I think, before we put some Job Z provisions together, I think that would be helpful. We certainly want it to work for the department. We would want it to work for labor and industry and for whoever has to carry it out. So some suggestions, I think, would be helpful.
Thank you. Yeah, we'll think about that.
Thank you. Anything else on Job Z? Mr. Moe, thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you
for
very much.
Thanks. Coming. Senator Langseth. And members, probably want to keep this nice color Job Z packet in your folder for when we have Commissioner McElroy here to discuss the governor's initiative. Senator Langseth.
Mr. Chair.
Senate File 245.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, many years ago, the Minnesota side of the river along the state of North Dakota, those communities were not doing well at all. The largest communities in North Dakota are Fargo and Grand Forks, and Wahpeton is also a fairly sizable community. And as I had mentioned, the state of North Dakota was doing all kinds of things to entice businesses and people to their side of the river. So we did implement border cities legislation, which I think first helped to stabilize the communities on the Minnesota side, and now particularly in the case of Moorhead, they are now really getting their share of the population increase and so on. One of the things we always had in it was, in that provision, was $1.5 million fund that would be divided by population to the different communities. And I have with me the mayor and a city official in Moorhead that can, I think, explain pretty much what they've been doing with this money and why it was essential that that we be able to match some of the incentives that were across the river.
Chair Bach, members of the Senate Tax Committee, thank you very much for having us here today. We appreciate that. First of all, Moorhead is on the other end of I-94. We're on the western edge of Minnesota. As I greet people coming to Moorhead, I tell them welcome to the west coast of Minnesota. I'm here representing all five of the communities that work with this program. The different mayors chose apparently to have us come up since we are very active using this. We started having this program in 1983. I became a council member in 1988. In the time period when I first came on the Morehead City Council, we weren't losing businesses to Fargo and to North Dakota. I think the word hemorrhage was probably a better way to describe it. We were losing businesses virtually weekly. And the reason is, as Senator Langseth has pointed out, we had a situation where in Minnesota we have definitely things that we give our citizens and work with our citizens. North Dakota is basically a low-tax, low-benefit type state, and they're concerned over the years that they've been losing population. They're very aggressive on trying to find ways to get businesses into their state and into the and get to citizens moved into North Dakota. Consequently, we needed to find some ways to balance that. We found that this Border Cities legislation has been a phenomenal tool for us. It stopped that hemorrhage that I saw personally starting in 1988. It's slowed it down substantially. It's still there to a degree, but it has slowed substantially. In fact, using this tool, we've been able to start actually getting a few businesses that moved over to North Dakota or that had started in North Dakota and come back over or locate in Morehead as they're expanding. That's pretty exciting news for us. And as I'm saying, we really still need this program. Just to give you an example, one of the things that we do with it, we buy down existing businesses' workman's compensation. North Dakota is the lowest workman's comp state in the country by far. We in Minnesota pay quite a bit more. My real job is being an electrical contractor. I'm an electrician for a living. My company pays roughly $7,300, or they did last year, in workman's comp. If I were to move my business 1 mile west, so I'd be in North Dakota, I could probably at least half that, maybe even a little more. The Border Cities legislation buys back, so to speak, about $1,000 worth of my workman's comp through this program. That's a quick, really easy example I can give you. And it's there for all the companies in Morehead that apply for it. We see a need as we move forward. As I said, North Dakota and the city of Fargo are very aggressive. Right now, the North Dakota legislature is in session as we are. They meet every other year. There's already several things that we've heard that they're looking at to see what they can do to help themselves a little more to Minnesota businesses. And what I see is this is a fabulous tool that we've established to keep our businesses in Morehead and maybe get a few others to locate into our community.
Chair, members, my name is Scott Hutchins, Community Services Director for the City of Morehead. And the communities that we're discussing here, these border communities in northwest Minnesota, are contiguous to communities in the state of North Dakota. We have, as the mayor has mentioned, the outgrowth of the Border City program came through studies of state agencies noting that throughout the state, on the borders of the state of Minnesota, it was this area that was most impacted by competition, and the competitive disparities in various ways manifested themselves in terms of growth and development of the Minnesota communities versus their North Dakota neighbors. And that is the subject of the handout that you have and some of the charts that are included to suggest that while progress has been and is being made, these competitive disparities continue to persist. And the graphs are essentially graphs that illustrate whether it's all of the communities or some of these are specific to the Morehead-Fargo situation, that whether it be in property tax valuation or the portion of taxable base that is commercial industrial versus other classifications of property, or rates of population growth or lack thereof, or sales tax, It just is a persistent problem that continues, which is in certainly in part assisted and aided by these border city programs that persists on the border with North Dakota. North Dakota, as Senator Langseth and the mayor have alluded to, have been very aggressive in their economic development programs over the years. They are, as the mayor indicates, low tax, low spend, low benefit state. But the counter to that is a rather aggressive state when it comes to economic development programs. They have creative venture capital programs. Provide corporate through their economic development programs, provide corporate income tax abatement as well as property tax abatement, and have a full variety of job training and worker training programs. The mayor alluded to the workers' compensation differences between the two states, and in large measure that comes from the method by which North Dakota applies its workers' compensation rates. There are situations where the rates in the two states are roughly equivalent, maybe just apart a bit, but in North Dakota, the workers' compensation rate per 100 is applied only to, at this point, the first $18,000 of salary. And therefore, even though rates may be somewhat similar in some instances, they're far apart in others, but nevertheless, when you apply to a fraction of salary, the total rate paid then in premium is significantly higher. So in summary, the basis for which the programs were originally developed was sound, a targeted relief. Some of the problems continue to persist, but certainly progress is being made. As Senator Langseth noted, in some additional economic activity in Moorhead that we're greatly appreciative of. Thank you.
You know, the school district in Moorhead was going through decline about 200 students a year, and then that gradually diminished. And last year, for the first time, they actually had a slight growth. And there's about 500 building permits in Moorhead this last year. So a number of things are happening that are very positive. And this is just one piece of Border Cities legislation. There's other parts of it I think that are probably considered to be more significant than this, but it really has done a lot of good on the border.
Senator Langseth, I certainly support the intent. I'm looking at the authors of the bill. You and Senator Stump, the bill applies to Western cities, Western border cities. Do we have any other members of the Senate that have any of these cities that receive any of this funding?
Ortonville. Ortonville is actually on the South Dakota border, but that would.
Do we know who represents Ortonville?
Yes, the new senator. It was Senator Sam's district.
The new guy.
Senator Scogin?
No.
Ingebrigtsen.
Senator Langseth, you might want to tell him you have the bill. It would be nice to have bipartisan support for this bill.
Well, you won't let it through unless it got bipartisan support. Is that a deal?
Senator Langseth, my problem is going to be I've had two arm wrestling matches with Senator Cohen already.
Okay.
And right now we're wrestling for one-time money, and we're going to have another match tomorrow, and I'm bringing in you and Senator Pogemiller to help me. To make sure that this committee gets some of the one-time money. So I figure with you and Senator Pogemiller and myself, three of us of the four in the meeting, we should be able to get some one-time money and do some of these good things like in your bill.
Senator Bach, if you need help in a wrestling match with Senator Cohen, you're in trouble.
He's pretty Senator Langseth, he's been here longer than me. He knows a lot of moves.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair, I was saying that maybe we should sell tickets.
Senator Limmer.
We could send the revenue that we raise on the tickets up to Moorhead.
But, that's true. We could dedicate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to raise a question. It seems like this is kind of a historical issue that we keep dealing with all the time, and I got to admit, Minnesota is not and thankfully not in North Dakota. We have a rich diversity of economic sources that we can rely on, where more of the prairie states are more just cash crop generated economies. But nevertheless, it does point out a little bit of when we have a state that has the type of tax policies that we have, we run into these competitive things that businesses and cities and taxpayers have to deal with. I was wondering, there's another issue that's going to be facing us in the near future. Could you tell me what kind of economic impact a total smoking ban would have on your businesses in your communities?
Interesting you should ask that, Senator.
Because we have to raise, hopefully we'll have that discussion of what kind of revenue impact that would have on our budget as well, not to mention the impact on gambling, charitable gambling, when it's dropped.
Really?
When you have a smoking ban in restaurants or in counties, we're seeing a measurable, almost a 20% drop in charitable gambling revenue streams.
Senator Limmer, I have requested a fiscal note on the bill. I don't know what revenue is going to say.
Okay.
And I'm hopeful that we'll get that before the bill is headed for the Senate floor.
I've done the same. So. But I wanted to know from a border perspective, is that an impact that you're concerned about?
Mr. Chair, Senator, my drive last night to come down here was 3.5 hours. About an hour and a half of that was talking to two of my council members on this very issue of smoking. Right now, the city of Moorhead is one of four communities of our metro area, Moorhead, Fargo, Dilworth, Minnesota, and West Fargo, North Dakota. We, as four councils and commissions, have created a task force, and it's very unusual in our four communities because they are membered with council members and commissioners only. So the decisions made by that group come back directly to our governing board. We are discussing the issue of smoking because it does have an impact on our businesses. Both Fargo and Moorhead and West Fargo, to a degree, have a smoking ban on everything except bars. And we in Minnesota have defined bars slightly different than what North Dakota has, Fargo has, but that's simply because of the way state laws are structured and liquor licenses are created. But it's pretty close right now. We do have a concern that if Minnesota were to go totally smoke-free, and North Dakota, whose legislature is also talking about a smoke-free environment, if one state and not the other goes, what will happen? And, of course, our concern is we will see that probably a little quicker in Minnesota. We are working with these four communities, with these elected groups, simply because we want to have a preemptive strike, so to speak. We would like to at least get the two large communities, Fargo and Moorhead, to go to a total smoking ban so that we don't have that situation. We know that our neighboring community, Dilworth, is not going to go forward. They're going to wait and see what the state does. And West Fargo on the other side kind of is in that same boat.
Mr. Chair, you might want to label that preemptive strike provision the lucky strike provision.
No.
I'm stretching, I know. But I can understand how, you've got a drain, and you don't need anything else to further exacerbate the problem.
Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Chairman Bach, I think. I think Senator Limmer was hoping he would rouse a response from me. It's a valid concern, and I'm sensitive to the concern that border cities have, although I'm not the chief author, of course, of this bill, but I'm identified strongly with it, of course. And I think it's fine to look at fiscal notes. Fiscal notes in the past have found no effect on the state budget, but if we're talking about overall economic effect, we also have to keep in mind, of course, the health effect and the huge benefit there is to our healthcare budgets, private businesses and public. Just look to the experience of other states, other cities who have been through this already, and they find little to no effect, even for the border cities. Duluth is a great case in point. But it's legitimate and valid to raise the concern and the issue and to look at it closely.
Any other discussion?
Mr. Chair, do we have a bad pun rule in this committee? We have one strike against a...
Don't say strike.
Mr. Chair, Senator,
if anything I've learned from this discussion is leave comedy to trained professionals.
Chair will lay Senate File 245 over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. And Senator Lang said that just will depend on how much one-time money we can get, but I certainly would like to be able to do this.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That concludes the business we have today, members. Next week, I think the division is meeting on Tuesday. This committee will meet probably on Wednesday and Thursday. We've got a couple of department bills in our possession that we'll have the department come in and go over, and I believe one of those 2 days we're going to take Commissioner Ines up, his confirmation. So probably plan on 2 days next week. We don't know for sure if it will take two, but Senator Limmer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pogemiller had breached the subject the other day on having scheduled sessions on Fridays. And I was just wondering if you as a committee chair were planning on having committee hearings on Fridays this early in the in the session.
Senator Limmer, I think at some point we're certainly going to do that. Right now, if this committee meets twice and the division meets once next week, that'll be 3 days next week. Mm-hmm. We still don't have a lot of bills referred to this committee, and council tells me the drafting is down significantly from previous years. So at this point, I don't plan to hear property tax or TIF bills in this full committee. They'd be heard in the division, and then the division would send up articles, I hope, for us to for the full committee to consider. So much of the work of the committee is going to be done in the division. So I think, at least for now, 3 days next week will be adequate. But at some point, we'll move to four as we get some more local bills to hear.
Okay. All right.
Anything else? This committee's adjourned.